Good morning, I'm Mark Purcell, and this is the Book Club at 91.7, a show sharing conversations with writers and readers. The mission of this radio show is to engage readers and writers and share their passion for books. You can be part of the show by emailing us, book@wvxu.org, or by calling our Book Club hotline, 513-352-9188, and answering our question of the month. This morning, three books that center around women. Kara Cooney talks about The Woman Who Would Be King later on the show. You'll hear about a murder scandal in Cincinnati surrounding a savage seamstress from Richard O. Jones in about 20 minutes. And to begin with Halloween coming up next weekend, witches. The Book Club at 91.7. I'm Mark Purcell. Thanks for listening this morning. And with a Halloween looming, I have a special guest here in the studio who will talk about witches. And this is not fictional witches, but the real witches. Catherine Howe is the editor of the new book, The Penguin Book of Witches. And it goes back and looks at some documents that chart the history of witches here in the United States and where they came from in England as well. Catherine Howe, welcome to the Book Club at 91.7.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark. I have to say, as I work on this book and talk to people about it, I feel like I need to work on a cackle. I need to get a cackle ready or something.
Well, I'm sure we'll add one in here at some point during the interview. But I wanted to ask, you do have, shall we say, a background in witches because you are a direct descendant of three accused Salem witches.
I know, it's true. It's a little bit crazy. It's true. One of them is a woman who has the same last name as me. Actually, her name is Elizabeth Howe. And she was one of the women who was hanged during the sort of the first wave of the Salem Panic. Another is a woman named Elizabeth Proctor, who is probably best known as a character in The Crucible. The real Elizabeth Proctor was the second wife, I think she was the second wife, of John Proctor, who was put to death. And Elizabeth was condemned, and she was supposed to be put to death, but she received a temporary stay because she was expecting a baby. And fortunately for her, by the time she came to be delivered, her sentence had been commuted, so that was a bit of a relief. And the third was the one I found out most recently, just by remarkable coincidence, was a woman named Deliverance Dane. She was accused near the end of the panic. Fortunately for her, she was never really in danger. But the reason that she's kind of fascinating is, for me anyway, is because, by coincidence, she is the subject of the first novel that I ever wrote, which is called The Physic Book of Deliverance Dane. So as you can imagine, when I found out about her, when I was poking around on the internet not too long ago, my brain basically exploded and started dripping down the walls.
Well, I was going to say, because I was going to mention, boy, that was in your first book, but you didn't know when you wrote that book?
I did not. I had no idea.
Wow.
It's funny. If you read a lot of even histories of witchcraft, if you read John Putnam Demos, for instance, or if you read Mary Beth Norton, there's a strange tendency of weird coincidences in witchcraft history. So if you read the introductions to any of their books, you'll find similar revelations.
Well, in this day and age, a lot of folks just figure witches have been around forever, but that's not necessarily true. Is that a fair statement?
I mean, it depends on how we define a witch, but I think certainly the heyday, for lack of a better turn of phrase, for witchcraft was during the early modern period. I think we tend to associate it with the Middle Ages, and it was around to some extent at that time. But when we think about witch trials, and particularly when we think about Salem, the real kind of flowering of witch trials occurred during the early modern period. So that's roughly the, depending on who you ask, the 1500s into the 1600s. And so the Penguin Book of Witches is a collection of primary source documents. So primary sources are sources from the actual time period. So a secondary source is a book about primary sources. It's a primary source reader about witchcraft in English North America and its English antecedents. So it starts in the 1500s, and it goes all the way up through Salem, and then after Salem into the 1700s.
I found it very interesting that King James himself was involved in when it came to witches, not as a witch, but as one who says, watch out for these witches.
He wrote a book called Demonology, and this is King James of King James Bible fame, which is actually not a coincidence. There had been English translations of the Bible before the King James Bible, but they had been subject to some criticisms by Puritan and Protestant theologians. So the King James Bible was undertaken under the king's auspices. And King James was, of course, the head of the church and the state. And so part of his goal in writing a book about demonology, where, among other things, he points out that witches are real, but werewolves are a delusion, in case you're wondering. He gets very particular about it. One of the goals that King James is trying to do is to demonstrate his intellectual mastery, but also his spiritual mastery, to kind of reinforce his position as head of the church.
And you point out in the book and through these primary source documents that really that is what it boils down to when it comes to witches or accused witches. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a power play for those in power and the church to be able to assert their own control over things.
It's true. It's funny because witch trials and accusations function on a couple of different levels of society. I think on the top level of society, it's an opportunity to define religious dogma, to define social dogma, to kind of reinforce social hierarchies to some degree. But it also works on an interpersonal level. It works between people in a village. In Puritan North America, they followed such a strict code of religious belief. They felt that it was not possible to do anything to have your soul be saved. You couldn't confess. You couldn't buy an indulgence. It was entirely up to God. And that meant that for some people, they would look to how their lives were going to understand the state of their soul, rightly or wrongly. And what that meant was if you had an everyday occurrence, say you were a mother and you had a young child who was scalded in the kitchen and then died from the burn. This was actually a very common injury. It was one of the top ways that women and children died during this period. If you had that everyday tragedy befall you, isn't it more of a relief to have someone to blame it on? So rather than to think, what does this mean about my own soul or my own state of affairs? So witchcraft was an important idea, not just within a power structure, but also between people and the ways that people related to each other, particularly in a time period before, say, you know, a police force, when all sort of social engagements were mediated by reputation and by relationship.
I'm speaking with Catherine House. She's the editor of The Penguin Book of Witches, available in bookstores now. You can learn more about it at wvxu.org. I'm talking witches here as Halloween approaches on the book club at 91.7. I wanted to ask about how the perception of witches has changed, because you point out towards the end of the book, as you're looking at the transition between the Salem accused witch trials, when people were executed, to where the witchcraft became less of a something punishable by death.
Right.
And people began, I guess you could say, to approach it more rationally. But there's still a great fascination today.
Yes and no, I would say, on the more rationally question. I mean, I think that there's this widespread perception that after Salem, we suddenly awoke in a sudden rush of enlightenment, reason, you know.
And, well, I didn't mean to imply that at all.
No, but I think that that is, it's an easy conclusion to draw. But the anti-witchcraft statute in England was changed in 1735. And that was the law that governed the trials in North America, because, of course, we were part of Britain at the time. And the anti-witchcraft statute changed in 1735 from witchcraft being against the law and a felony punishable by death to pretending to witchcraft being against the law, which I think is an interesting distinction, because it does not mean that belief in witchcraft has gone away. It means that it is of a different kind of threat. And there are a couple of ways to explain that. One way is to look at the movement into the Enlightenment and into the scientific revolution, and that's part of it. Part of it is a change in religious life. Part of it also, you could argue, is that by the time we get into the 18th century, we're entering our first consumer revolution, actually. It's this time when we get Wedgwood pots, for instance, when we start to have the beginnings of mass production, strangely enough. And so in the 17th century, even well-off people lived in a life of relative scarcity, where, you know, losing your porringer was actually a substantial loss of your household goods. And by the time we get to the 18th century, we live in a time of marginally less scarcity. So there's the risk that witchcraft poses, because most accusations of witchcraft had to do with the household, had to do with the body, had to do with health, had to do with livestock or with food. By the time we get into the 18th century, those issues, on average, are a bit less pressing than they had been. And yet at the same time, the fact that there is an inherent risk in people pretending to be witches and taking money. It's against being a charlatan, essentially. Indicates, at least to me, I would argue, that witchcraft belief has simply receded from the legal realm, but persists in the cultural realm.
I also learned from reading the Penguin Book of Witches that although Salem gets all the notoriety, that actually it was Andover, Massachusetts, where most of the true action happened.
It's true. The Salem Panic is actually a bit of a misnomer to call it the Salem Witch Trials because, first of all, it starts in Salem Village. There are two Salems, I hasten to add. There's Salem Village and Salem Town. Salem Town is on the water. And in the 1690s, Salem Town is the same size as Boston. I mean, it's growing very rapidly. It's a pretty well-off community. It's a center of shipping and trade. By the 19th century, Salem is actually wealthier than Boston because it's the center of the China trade. And so very quickly, the land along that strip of water is a bit rocky. And so it's hard to grow enough food for a growing community like that. And so they had established an outlying farm region. And in fact, you see this mirrored naming in a nearby town. There's a Beverly, Massachusetts, and a Beverly Farms, Massachusetts, which is inland. So Salem Village had been established as Salem Farms. And the cultures of the two communities, they were closely related, but they had started to diverge a bit. They'd started to diverge a bit spiritually. There were some political tensions between the two. Salem Village had had trouble holding on to their own minister. This is true, I think, in congregations today. You see this happening sometimes.
There's
a politics to who the minister is going to be and whether he's popular enough. So Samuel Parris was their third minister in a pretty short period of time. I want to say less than a decade. And Samuel Parris also had not initially been called to the church. He'd started out running a plantation in Barbados. That is actually where Tituba Indian came from. She was a slave on his Barbados plantation. He ran his Barbados plantation into the ground, and he came to Boston. He tried to make it as a businessman. That didn't fly. And so then he joined the church and came to Salem Village, a community already in spiritual crisis. And then he quickly made himself irritating. He wanted them to give him the right to his parsonage. Then they wanted to maybe get rid of him, so they cut off his firewood. There was all this like back and forth and irritating stuff that was going on. It's interesting that it starts in Salem Village and seems to be very much a story of this one tiny community. And yet, quickly, the accusations spread to Andover and actually to surrounding communities. There are people accused as far away as Maine, which, of course, is part of Massachusetts at that time. It was called the Eastern Frontier. There was a witch from Marblehead. There are many witches from Topsfield. It might be more accurate to call it the Essex County witch trial because it spread so widely. And in fact, one of the most persuasive history books about this is a book called In the Devil's Snare, which talks about the influence and aftershocks of the attacks of Indian and French, combined forces of Indian and French, along the Maine frontier, which kept pushing settlement back into Essex County. It's a really vibrant and gripping period of time, and I think more vibrant and gripping than the sort of typical picture we have of young girls screaming with napkins on their heads.
Well, you have used witches and the witch hysteria, if you may, in your fictional books, the Physic Book of Deliverance Dane and Conversion.
Yeah.
But why did you feel it's important to tell the real stories of witches?
Well, I think one of the great pleasures of being a novelist, and especially a novelist who writes historical fiction, is that I get to engage with readers who are so interesting and curious. And so many of us read historical fiction because we want to learn about the history. But for whatever reason, maybe the history that we've encountered up until this point has been kind of dry, like memorizing dates and battles and who was president and who was William McKinley and I find history much more vibrant and engaging than that. And so I think my readers know that when I give them a historical fiction novel, because I come from a history background, I've done the homework. You know, they can trust that I'm going to give them details of life at that time. Even if I'm weaving a fantasy out of it, whatever fantastical story I'm telling is actually based in beliefs of the time that I'm talking about, whatever time it might be. And so one of the great pleasures of being a novelist has been meeting readers and engaging with readers and talking to them about history. And I felt like so many of us were curious to learn more, especially about the reality behind witchcraft and the history of witches, and didn't necessarily have a good path to these documents. I mean, they're all out there. You can find them if you know where to look. Mm-hmm. And that can be a pretty specialized body of knowledge. So my hope with the Penguin Book of Witches is if someone is curious to learn about why we believed what we believed in North America for hundreds of years about witches, they can take the Penguin Book of Witches, they can read the introduction, they can read my contextualizing little essays, read the notes that I've made because there's some footnotes to help clarify certain weird word usages or weird, you know, parenthetical references. And if you sit and read the Penguin Book of Witches from beginning to end, that you'll come away with a good foundation for understanding why we had these crazy beliefs in the early modern period, and also with a good kind of inspiration to go learn more if that's something that would be interesting.
Catherine Howe, what are you reading?
You know what? Right now I'm actually listening to Moby Dick.
Really?
I am. I never actually finished it, and I'm a bit of a sailor, and so I've been listening to Moby Dick. It's amazing. I can't believe I waited this long to read it. It's incredible.
Catherine Howe is the editor of the Penguin Book of Witches and also the author of the Physic Book of Deliverance, Dane, and Conversion, all available where books are sold. You can find out more about Catherine and her work on our website, wvxu.org. Catherine, thanks again for being here at the Book Club at 91.7.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
Hi, I'm Chris Messick from the Mercantile Library. Coming up on Tuesday, we're bringing in Donald Shoup. He's the author of a book called The High Cost of Free Parking, and he's a UCLA professor. It's been referred to as the rock star of parking. And he is going to talk about ways that parking policy affects urban life. He's coming in for our Pyle Urban Lecture, which talks about urban issues. Anyway, he believes that parking should be treated like any other commodity, where it's based on demand. He thinks if parking is priced appropriately, which usually means a little bit more expensive, there should be one or two open spots on any block at any time, but no more than that. And he also thinks that mandated minimum parking policies, you know, if you build an office building, you need to build X number of parking spaces. He thinks those are a bad idea. They drive up the cost of development, drive the value of urban land down, so he thinks they need to be if not eliminated, at least set more appropriately and have a little bit more thought put into them. So he's a great speaker. He's funny, dynamic, exciting talk about parking. So, and something I think is very topical for Cincinnati right now, because, you know, people driving around looking for parking spots lead to congestion because you're driving around behind them, even if you know exactly where you're going. It should be a good show, and that's the 28th at the Mercantile Library. Visit wvxu.org for a link to our Mercantile Library website.
The Woman Who Would Be King, later on the Book Club at 91.7, and straight ahead after a short break, The Savage Seamstress of Cincinnati.